Now listen up.
Coming to you from a toddler's playroom in the Lone Star State. Welcome to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History, where we ramble and you listen. Bringing you weird history, food science, and the facts you didn't know you needed. Here are your hosts, Bob and Tom.
Hi, historians. Got milk? This episode, we're going to be exploring the history of milk, how industrialization, urbanization, and beer breweries / dairies affected milk regulation. Does milk really build strong bones and teeth? We're also going to explore a few interesting characters along the way, like Louis Pasteur, who never actually pasteurized milk, the Prohibition Chicago bootlegging mobster Al Capone, and use sell-by dates on dairy, Gail Borden, Civil War combat rations, and the first truly safe, albeit fattening, transportable milk, Edward Jenner, milkmaids, and the first vaccinations. So strap yourselves in, historians, for an utterly fascinating episode. Now, first, you can actually earn a PhD in dairy science, so the subject is vast and covers many different types of products. Now, for this episode, we're going to just concern ourselves mainly with milk from the mammary glands of animals. We'll make future episodes to discuss cheese, other dairy products, and the increasingly popular plant-based milks.
Wow, a PhD in dairy science.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool? Complicated.
Yeah. There's a lot of science there. Well, a lot of engineering that goes into dairy plants.
Well, especially
pasteurization.
I mean, maybe processes. Not back in the day, but now in the industrial age.
Well, a lot of chemistry and microbiology, and you start thinking about yogurts and the different type of dairy products that are out there. Yeah, it's quite a bit.
So, like you said, milk is produced in the mammary glands of all female mammals. Human milk is not commercially produced, but it can be donated through like breast milk banks or like friends and organizations that distribute it to infants who require it for various reasons, whether it's the mother doesn't have a supply, like, so she can't provide it, or maybe the baby's not taking to formula as well. I mean, there's a million different reasons.
Neonates, and I had saw a thing on TV a while back where there was a gentleman that had prostate cancer, and he was starting to drink breast milk and believes that it would actually help him, you know, keep the prostate cancer at bay.
Oh, wow.
Sounds a little odd, but, you know, maybe there's something to it.
Well, so kind of an aside, when Jenna, or when our baby girl was first born and Jenna was breastfeeding, she was producing a lot of milk, and there was actually a lady in our neighborhood who was not. I mean, I don't know if it was a lack of production or I don't know what, for whatever reason, her baby boy was not growing as fast as the doctors wanted, and he was having some digestive issues. So Jenna actually ended up donating quite a bit to that lady, and from what I've seen on Facebook, at least on the neighborhood page, the boy seems to be doing a lot better, and he looks pretty
big
and healthy.
Yeah, I think it's a great
now.
Thing. It's like the holy grail of dairy science to be able to reproduce what's actually in the human milk, especially the first couple of weeks there, the colostrum that's coming out for the first few days.
Yeah, and I was reading something about, like, human breast milk actually has, like, I don't know, what is it, like, a couple hundred or a thousand different proteins or something along those lines.
Yeah,
something's in the milk that they can't reproduce exactly the same in the formula. They can capture 10 of the proteins, 20, whatever it is, 20 of the proteins, something along those lines, but they can't quite reproduce the exact same complement of proteins and vitamins
and antibodies
that happen in antibodies that happens in breast milk. So anyway, so let's talk about cows. So the biggest breed of cattle that is responsible for milk production is actually called the Holstein dairy cow. And they account for about 90% of milk production in the U.S. and Great Britain. So these ladies, they're actually usually milked at least twice a day. I think sometimes three.
Yeah.
But I think the standard is at least usually morning and evening. In automated milking parlors, and that does two things. So one, it relieves the cow because
there's a lot of pressure there. Yeah. They'll actually see them. They'll walk to the stalls to be milked.
Yeah, because they need that relief.
Yeah,
because they're getting kind of full up.
Yeah.
And the regular milking schedule keeps them producing pretty efficiently. So, according to the USDA, the U.S. dairy industry produced 218 billion pounds of milk in 2019.
That's a crazy number.
Yeah, that's a lot. So, let's do a little bit of math. So, a gallon of milk weighs an average of about 8.6 pounds. So, if we do a little bit of math here, we figure out that it's about 25 billion gallons of milk that were produced in the United States last year. Or not last year anymore, the year before, 2019. Last year, I guess, technically is 2020 now.
That's a lot of milk.
That's a lot of milk. And that's just from dairy cows.
And that's just the United States.
Yeah.
I was looking at, now India is the largest producer in the world now. They were quite deficient for a number of years, and the World Health Organization and several other organizations around the world went in, helped them set up dairies, and now they produce more milk than any other country. And there is actually a milk glut worldwide, so a lot of countries aren't accepting milk to be imported in.
Or they're not exporting or whatever.
Yeah, because it's just going on in Canada right now. Yeah, they won't let any milk in.
Oh, wow. When we talk about this milk, it's not just like the milk you see in the gallon jug. We're also talking about the milk that's used to make ice cream, butter, cheeses, yogurts, and all kinds of other dairy products. And the dairy lobby is actually so powerful that the USDA gave dairy its own food group. Remember on that pyramid? Yeah. So the USDA gave them their own chunk of that pyramid, their own food group.
That was pretty interesting.
Yeah, and they suggested 2 to 3 servings per day. So the dairy industry was lobbying the government, and then the USDA decided, oh yeah, it should be a part of your balanced nutrition on that food pyramid.
Yeah, you know, and if you speak to vegans, you know, you don't need dairy. And in fact, a lot of them don't like the fact that they are being, you know, forced to be milked every day and live on these farms. They should be all let loose to go, you know, wander around out in the wilderness and live their own lives free out in the prairie.
And yeah, I mean, that would probably be a better life for a cow, but milking a cow doesn't hurt it.
No. And you got to figure too, they're also, you know, probably pretty safe there on the farm. They haven't got to worry about, you know, wolves and other creatures coming out and killing them.
Yeah. Other than cow's milk, at least in the U.S. and probably across I know goat's milk is really big across the world, but
yeah.
I was going to talk about goat and bison milk are also two popular alternatives to the Holstein dairy cow. And I know there's a million different goat cheeses out there, and goat milk is much more popular in other parts of the world than the U.S., like actually drinking goat milk.
Yeah, but they say, though, that it lacks in certain types of enzymes, and so kids that are fed specifically nothing but goat's milk and they're westernized children, they start to have some, you know, physical problems after a while.
Hmm.
That's because, you know, westernized kids were, you know, our gut microflora isn't as good as the children of other countries.
Mm-hmm. So. And bison milk. I mean, I've always assumed, like, you could probably milk a female bison.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a big market for bison milk.
Yeah, neither.
So how did we get here? When most humans lose their ability to digest lactose, actually, like, before they become adults, usually after you wean from breastfeeding, if that's what you're doing, your body starts slowly processing down its ability to digest lactose and lactase persistence.
Yeah, so nobody's really quite sure when humans first began to drink milk from other animals. Now, it's actually presumed that around the Neolithic period, which is 9,000, 7,000 BC, in Mesopotamia, That's when animals first started being domesticated: cattle, sheep, goats, camel, and a few others. Now, this is starting to occur pretty regularly, and milk from these animals is being consumed. You can see pictographs on walls of these old monuments and some of the old temples and tablets, clay tablets. There's writing about milk. An article in Nature in 2018 had actually suggested that some pottery shards from Southwest Asia contain milk fats that are dated to like the 7th millennium BC. Now that's 9,000 years ago. That's a long time. And milk didn't reach Britain and Scandinavia until around the 4th millennium BCE. So that's about 6,000 years ago. East Asia, Australia, and the Americas didn't really use milk very much, and it wasn't really popular in the diet until after the European colonization around 500 years ago. I was talking about the pictographs that are dating to the mid-third millennium BC that show Sumerians milking a cow and then making cheese and butter. And then by 3100 BC, the cow had been introduced or separately domesticated in East Africa. They're not really sure. The Egyptians, though, revered the cow, and they actually had a goddess named Hathor, who was a deified cow. There are ancient Egyptian medical treatments for burns that suggested bandages soaked in human milk from a mother of a male baby to be placed on the affected burn areas. I don't know, what would happen if you used the milk from a mother of a female baby on those
Yeah,
burns.
I don't know what the difference would be there. I mean, maybe there's something. Who knows? I'm assuming they came across male baby specific breast milk somehow. I mean, someone made a decision there.
So by 2000 BC, the cow arrival coincides with the arrival of the nomadic Aryans in India. The Vedas of the Hindu religion later deified the cow as well, just as they did in Egypt. And about 1700 BCE, you have the Bible describing milk and milk products, and I believe there's more than 50 different references to milk in the Bible. And 20 different times, Palestine is referred to as the land of milk and honey due to its fertility in the Bible. And the Romans actually used a hard cheese as a combat ration. And in the Middle Ages, milk was called the virtuous white liquor, as it was often much safer to drink milk than water. People got sick from the water all the time back then. Latrines upstream, kind of
Yeah.
thing.
So the Romans used hard cheese as a combat ration. I guess that kind of makes sense because some of those hard cheeses do store pretty well.
Yeah, you think like, Parmesan cheese, it's really hard, and 18 months to 2 years, I think, to even get it to its right consistency.
Yeah, I mean
And
it
so those
sits,
other
I
ones
think it
for a
might be
long
longer
time.
than that. I think it might sit in a building for like 3 years before it's considered ripened enough.
Very low moisture.
So it probably holds pretty well, and I guess that makes sense as a combat ration.
Low moisture. I'm sure those guys were dropping pellets.
Oh yeah.
Just like eating MREs.
So let's talk about natural selection for a second. So we figured out by this point that it was a genetic mutation and then some subsequent natural selection that occurred in parts of the world that actually led to some populations being lactose tolerant, I guess, and some being lactose intolerant. And so the tolerance is known as lactase persistence, which basically means that your body throughout your life continues to make this enzyme called lactase that can break down the lactose or milk sugar in the milk, and that's what keeps you from getting bloated and gassy and having to run to the bathroom every few minutes. Whereas people who do not have lactase persistence. Usually sometime after weaning, that enzyme production starts to get throttled down for some reason.
Yeah, it seems like it's after about 2 years of age, it starts to slowly, and by the time they're adults, they have very little ability to drink milk at all.
Yeah, and so normally the lactose, by the time it hits your small intestine, that's where the lactase enzymes are sitting, along the lining of your small intestine, breaking down that lactose and making it into whatever. But those people that don't have that enzyme, it's filtering all the way through the small intestine, making it to the colon, and then the, I guess, colonic bacteria? Is that how you would call them?
Gut bacteria.
The good ones in the poop chute?
Yep.
So those bacteria do something different. They see that lactose as a sugar, and they're like, oh, yeah, this is good stuff. They eat it all up.
Yeah.
And then basically fart out CO2.
Yep.
And that's what creates the bloating and gassiness and rushing to the bathroom.
Yeah. Yep, all the other problems.
And so when we talk about this natural selection that occurred, so the recent research suggests that this occurred sometime as far back as at least 4,000 BC, and they think it pretty much coincides with the domestication of cows and other milk-producing animals. Now, when we talk about the populations that can tolerate it, it's mostly Northern Europeans, some populations from the Arabian Peninsula and the Mediterranean, actually
goats,
some
and camels, and,
yeah, some yeah. West African, some like sub-Saharan West African populations,
yeah.
And then Southeast Asian, like far Southeast Asians,
the people of the steppes, I think, you know, like the Mongols and stuff, because they had their horses and yaks and you know, other animals that they had there, and I want to say that I remember reading a reference to Mongol soldiers milking their mares and making cheese from it, and it had something to do with their ability to be able to ride hard, fast, and long ways.
Yeah, so they actually drank the mare's milk, and like you said, they made mare's cheese, and they did. They believed that that was some kind of power boost, so they would be able to ride their horde farther and faster.
It's pretty crazy.
And now, so we kind of already talked about it, but those populations outside of the ones we mentioned that are more predispositioned to be lactose intolerant, they suffer from a range of uncomfortable bowel maladies, gassiness, frequent trips to the bathroom, discomforts, stuff like that. Because of that lack of breaking down in the small intestine by that lactase.
And it's pretty terrible, too, you know, because they can't enjoy ice cream unless they have, you know, some kind of lactose-free milk.
Some kind of lactate, or if it's made from coconut milk or almond milk or
but
whatever other kind of milks that are out there.
The way that happened, we were just talking about that earlier before we even started the show, though, is that you have this huge population in northern Europe and then a sliver over in East Asia, a sliver in the Middle East, and a sliver in Africa. You know, how did it happen like that? And, you know, that most of the world's population still can't process milk very well. Even though, you know, like in China and Japan, it's not something that was hugely and widely drank like it was in Europe. And nowadays, in the last 30, 40 years, it's become wildly popular, especially ice cream shops and yogurt shops.
I think if I had to take a guess, it probably coincides with where the populations of early cattle were.
Yeah.
And where they were domesticated. Because the locations where people are more lactose tolerant tend to kind of match up where early cattle were domesticated.
Yeah, so did it have anything to do with Atlantis and aliens or anything like that, you think?
I mean, probably, yeah. Or alien overlords just did something random and said, let's see what happens.
Yeah, we should do a podcast about that. That would be interesting. So let me talk about this character, this guy, Edward Jenner. He was a country doctor. It was 1793. And there's a couple of different stories that go on about him. One says that he had noticed some milkmaids, and these milkmaids had cowpox sores on their arms, and noted that they did not, get smallpox when these smallpox epidemics would occur pretty randomly throughout the country. It's probably more likely that he overheard something in a conversation about milkmaids. Anyway, it leads him to this assumption that, well, if he could take some of the pus, ooh, from one of the sores on a milkmaid's arm, and then take that pus and wipe it into a scratch on a 8-year-old boy's arm, and then expose that 8-year-old boy to smallpox and see whether or not he gets smallpox and dies. And that,
I
I mean,
mean,
that's not exactly ethical today, but it's 1793, and, hey, a kid probably came from, a poorer station in life or something like that. It's just insane to think what
well, I
that
mean,
did. But it worked.
yeah, I mean, smallpox was pretty bad back in those days. I mean, it's still a bad disease. It's just not as common.
Yeah, I was reading it was a 1 in 13 people would actually die from smallpox. And then you've got blindness that happens and plus scars if you do survive. And when you think about 1 in 13 people in 1793 and people are dying from just about everything back then, the lifespan was about 40 years. And that's if you made it past 5 years of age.
Yeah, because those
So,
early years were the highest risk factor.
yeah. So anyway, he finds out that this boy doesn't catch smallpox, so he does a few more experiments on some other kids. It seems like they're all boys, because I guess boys are the only ones going to allow some pus to be wiped on them, get a scratch on their arm. But he actually did it to one of his sons as well. And very lucky, turned out that these kids didn't get smallpox, and he's accredited with being the first person to actually give out vaccines. So,
That's pretty
gone
cool.
down in history.
I guess that's kind of a happy accident.
But the thing about it is this was actually a medical practice that has been documented in ancient Chinese writings till about the 1500s. And it's probable that this actually came across through the Muslim conquests of the time, through the Middle East, and then made its way into Europe. And that's, and Jenner hears about it in the United States and some kind of a conversation, probably in a tavern someplace.
Well, yeah, a lot of like Western medicinal, what's the word I'm looking for?
Medicines,
Advancements
yeah.
are really based off of something that was happening in Eastern medicine for hundreds of years prior, usually, sometimes a
Yeah.
thousand years. They just take something that's been done before, put a new twist on it, and say, "Oh, look, we
Yeah, we
invented
invented
this."
this, yeah. And we're going to talk about that a couple more times in here, too.
All right, so let's take a little jump forward in history and talk a little bit about production of milk. So, before the industrialization in the mid-19th century, when people actually started moving from rural areas to cities, people knew their neighbors.
Yeah.
They were often the farmers doing the raising of the dairy cows and the milking. And you knew it was all kind of locally done. So, like whatever little town you lived in, there was the dairy farmer that lived there, and that's where you got your milk.
Yeah, or you owned your own cow, or the next door neighbor had one, and you could get that fresh milk within, an hour or so of it actually being taken out from the udder and into a bucket, and you knew it was clean, and the udders were washed off, and there was some cleanliness there.
And then during the industrialization period, that's when the mass flood to the cities happened. And so milk became a little more scarce in the cities. I mean, the land is expensive in the inner cities,
Yeah.
and there's not a whole lot of it available. So you're not really doing any dairy farming in the city. So it has to be brought in, it has to be transported in. And that brought a whole nother list of challenges.
Yeah, the supply chain, basically got longer and longer and longer. where I understand in the beginning you had some farmers that would actually walk the cow into the city and then, you know,
do the milking.
Do the milking right there, you know, in front of the person.
Bring them back to pasture at the end of the day or whatever the case was, yeah. But as, you know, these cities got bigger and bigger and bigger, that became unfeasible.
Yeah.
So farmers couldn't really, like, walk their cattle into the whatever stockyards or whatever it was in the city to be milked or whatever. Yeah. So, this process just became increasingly more difficult. And that actually, at first, led to a lot of unsanitary practices. So people were hauling older, spoiled milk into the cities, and it really created a big challenge.
You had these, in some of the bigger cities, you had these tenements that were starting to come up. We had, you know, a large immigrant population of, you know, say Irish that were coming in during the potato famine in Europe. And so they would live in these small buildings with, you know, 10, 15 people living in one room and the babies needing milk. And they would get their milk from somebody who got milk from a guy outside of town a day or two ago. And they're carrying it around in these dirty jugs. And it was just all kinds of diseases that children were dying from, that they're directly getting it from the milk.
So that's also the time that distilleries and breweries started growing in number in these industrialized cities.
Yeah,
and,
which I find fascinating.
Yeah, and so
that marries together.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy story. So as these distilleries and breweries grow in number and this competition starts rising, they're looking for ways to beat the competition and maximize profits. So one of the ways they go about this is they actually start purchasing all these stalls. And then they bring in cows and feed them the spent hot wash, the hot wet wash from the brewing process. So
all that mash that you've got there, the silage that's been put in there that the microbes are fermenting. Mm-hmm. And then they take that, which they would have probably just thrown it away before, and they feed it to the cows. The cows eat that and then produce the milk.
And then these brewing companies are then essentially becoming dairy companies as well and selling that milk to the city's residents. Now, it was unfortunate for the cows because they were pretty much in like a 4x10 or whatever the size of the stall is.
Yeah,
and they were pretty much stuck there. Like, that was it.
Yeah, the stories that start to get wrote are these cows would be there in their entire life and standing in their own feces, and somebody is coming in and milking them, and those people aren't clean. The buckets they're putting in them aren't clean. And so these cows started getting diseased as a, you know, after effect of, you know, how their life is.
And from the horrible diet that they're eating.
The only thing they're eating is this silage. So it's, they call them swill dairies at this time because, you know, the milk's going to be kind of nasty and disgusting. And that milk has actually gotten so bad and nasty and disgusting that a lot of these manufacturers are actually putting stuff in it like plaster. They're
water, rotten eggs, flour, burnt sugar, and basically anything else that they could.
Yeah, to change either the flavor, the color,
plus texture. Up the volume, change the color, change the texture, the flavor, whatever they could do to sell more of it. And they were marketing it as like pure country milk still, even while adding all this crap to the milk.
Yeah, making references to the Bible, you know. And talking about how it helped the temperance movement, you know, because you got a lot of people that are, you know, heavy drinkers at the time. And there's a lot of movements out there against drinking. And most people didn't know the same places that were making the alcohol were actually the same places that were producing the milk at the time. And so there was just a bunch of unscrupulous practices out there, you know, advertising practices.
Yeah, I mean, eventually news agencies and magazines did start catching on, And they started running exposés on the unsanitary nature of these practices. But obviously, you know, politicians and businessmen fought hard against the reforms that these news articles were talking about. And oftentimes they purchased their own magazines and ran their own articles to.
I mean, you have, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Tammany Hill politicians in New York. There was a lot of corruption, a tremendous amount of corruption. That's worthy of an entire podcast series by itself. Mm-hmm. But at that time, these politicians there, they were backing the dairies because they were making money off the dairies as well. Yeah. You know, they were leaning on them for money. A lot of these guys actually owned the dairies themselves, you know. And so they sit on the city commission boards, the health boards for the city, and anything that these people would write, they would just turn around and you know, make it into a lie and say that milk is wholesome. It's delicious. It's good for you and your children.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History with Bob and Tom. We'll be right back.
Hey, historians. This episode is brought to you by Friend Letters. Friend Letters allow you to send your kids, friends, family, or anyone else personalized holiday letters from your favorite holiday friends. Whether it's Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, or even one that you make up, Friend Letters will take the personalized information you provide and craft beautiful letters, certificates, or other products for the recipient. Their biggest hit this holiday season was the official Nice List certificate. It was personalized to the child and addressed from the North Pole's Christmas Cheer Department. Reach out to Friend Letters today, tomorrow, or whenever to provide some joy and to help ignite an imagination. You can reach Friend Letters at www.friendletters.com, on Facebook at Friend Letters TX, or Instagram at Friend Letters. Again, that's www.friendletters.com, on Facebook at Friend Letters TX, or Instagram at Friend Letters. Also, use promo code HISTORY to get 10% off your next purchase. Go to Friend Letters and get a personalized experience for someone you love.
And we're back to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History. Here are Bob and Tom.
So then we get to the late 1800s, and this is actually a pretty neat story. So the owners of the now booming Macy's department store actually lost one of their children to milk fever.
It's pretty horrible.
And it was probably due to, I don't know, salmonella, typhoid, brucellosis, or some kind of contaminant in the milk. I mean, who knows what it was. But the owners actually took it upon themselves to wage a personal crusade for milk safety regulations.
So, yeah, now you got somebody with money, position,
name recognition
that's actually pushing this kind of stuff. And so you start to see regulations being passed and ordinances coming about. Okay, so now in 1856, Louis Pasteur proved that wine subjected to heat would not spoil. Pasteur's research demonstrated that the growth of microorganisms were responsible for the spoilage of beverages such as beer, wine, and milk. Now, with this, he actually invented the process in which liquids such as milk were heated to temperatures between 60 and 100 degrees Celsius. This killed most of the bacteria and molds already present within them. The process is known as pasteurization, named after him. But, you know, oddly, we think of that being associated with milk, but Pasteur never actually did any studies on milk himself. You know, it was with alcohol that he was doing it at the time. And they were done in Germany, in France. He was the professor of numerous different universities and institutes, and he was a chemist, a microbiologist, engineer. He just did all kinds of stuff. The guy is famous for numerous things other than pasteurization. So, you know, proving the germ theory was probably the biggest thing there.
And funny aside here, how we talked about Western medicine stealing from Eastern medicine.
Yeah.
So heat treating wines, for example, for preservation, was actually known to the Chinese since like 1117 AD. They wrote about it in journals and in writings that they had. And then even a Japanese diary written by monks called Tomonin Nikki, and that was written between 1478 and 1618. They wrote about the same stuff, heat treating dairy products. Yeah. So like Eastern medicine and Eastern practices were way ahead of the ballgame.
Yeah. Then you see in the West, we co-opt the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
The winner of the war, you get to write the history, yep, right?
To the victor go the spoils, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So by 1880, pasteurization equipment had actually been introduced in Germany. Now, the initial aim for pasteurization was to eliminate the pathogens. That's the diseases that are going to get you sick. So, unfortunately, there's a lot of like heat-resistant spoilage microorganisms out there. So these organisms would cause the milk to have a bad smell, taste, curdle, do all kinds of stuff, which, you know, is the reason behind use-by dates. Not necessarily going to make you sick, but tastes pretty bad, look pretty bad. Best if used by. You know, it's all got to do with quality and not really kind of safety sort of things. Now, if pasteurization isn't sterilization, let me put that out there, you know, because you're just trying to set the heat high enough to kill the most virulent pathogen that might be in the medium. In this case, it's milk, right? A sterilization is actually getting rid of all living organisms that might be on there. There's another thing called commercial sterilization, which is used to refer to canning, which is just about sterilization, but there might probably be something in there which is going to cause that can to swell after a couple of years. Yeah. So anyway, milk is really a terrific medium for microbial growth, especially when it's stored at what they call it ambient temperature, which is room temperature, you know, around 70 degrees or so. And the CDC actually believes, and this is what they write, that milk stored at ambient temperature is responsible for 3 times as many hospitalizations than any other food. And that is, you know, unpasteurized types of milk too as well. And pasteurization techniques can prevent tuberculosis, brucellosis, diphtheria, scarlet fever, Q fever, salmonella, listeria, yersinia, campylobacter, staph aureus, E. coli 0157, and a whole bunch of other microorganisms that get you sick. These disease-causing organisms have been responsible for killing millions upon millions of people throughout history. So most liquid products are heated in a continuous system where the heat can be applied using a plate heat exchanger or direct or indirect use of hot water or steam. And due to the mild heat, there are just some minor changes in the nutritional quality or sensory characteristics of heat-treated food. And there's a lot of people out there that believe that pasteurization, eliminates a lot of the nutritional value that's in a particular food. It is true to a certain extent. There's some. It's pretty low. However, when it comes to like calcium, it seems like the bioavailability is somewhere around, you lose about 20%. So milk actually has calcium and vitamin D added back in it. And some of that has to do with the milk losing, you know, a certain amount, but it's got to do more with programs that the USDA are running to ensure that, you know, children, young adults are getting enough vitamin D in their diet. There is also another type of pasteurization that doesn't use heat, but actually uses high pressure, or they use a pulse electric field, or they use them all in combination. When you're looking for a way to kill a pathogen that is also a spore former, that means they've created like a little shell around their self that can they can survive in just about any kind of adverse environment and, you know, kind of wrap themselves up and be there for, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years sometimes. Mm-hmm. You need to hit that not only with heat, but also with high pressure or possibly this electrical field to make sure that the whatever it is you're worried about there has been brought down to an acceptable level.
Mm-hmm. So let's actually talk about a similar story to pasteurization. So in 1795, the French military offered 12,000 francs for a new food preservation method. So they were actually working with this Parisian chef and confectioner, and he started experimenting with different ways to preserve foods. He tried placing food in waxed, sealed glass containers and boiled them in water. And that was kind of the first canning preservation method, like kind of like what you were talking about before.
You know, what's kind of cool, though, is this is about the time that the French got their ass handed to them, basically, in Russia.
Yeah. One of the many times they got their asses handed.
Lost thousands and thousands of soldiers, and a lot of it had to do with the supply chain of food, you know? So they're looking for, you know, long-term rations.
Yeah, so after about 14 years of doing his experiments, he actually won the French prize, and he published the first modern food preservation cookbook. This ended up leading to tin cans and, like, the canning process as a whole becoming more common and industrialized. Now, however, it wasn't until Robert Yates invented the can opener, a hammer and a chisel, was needed to open cans. So, we had the canning process down, but it wasn't all that easy to open them, I guess.
Yeah, you've got these stories of soldiers, you know, shooting cans or, you know, using their bayonets and rocks to try to open up the cans that had, you know, boiled salted meat in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then in, let's fast forward to 1853, that's when Gail Borden invented a process for canning sweetened condensed milk. God, I love that stuff. Now, the Union Army purchased the milk, helping, like, the sales of the milk to boom, because they were looking for a product that could be kept, you know, during the war effort.
Yeah, it was a problem with, you know, milking cows during wartime as well, because they'd have to bring the cows with them. Mm-hmm. This way, they have a can that's got milk in it. It's sweetened. It's condensed. So they would actually add water back to it. Now, it doesn't taste exactly like milk would coming straight from the cow after it's been in a can and sweetened with sugar and then had water added back to it. And some of these people just actually drank it right out of the can sweet like that. But the Union soldiers fell in love with it. Uh-huh. And after the war was over, not only did, you know, sales boom because he was, you know, having his product bought by the Union Army and the military, and you know how the military is. We store stuff, and if it can be stored for a long time, they're going to store it for a long time. There's probably cans of that stuff still in a depot someplace rotting away.
Probably, you know? Yeah. So Gale was actually a pretty interesting character. So in 1823, he actually left New York for the great state of Texas. Here is where he helped survey the cities of Galveston and Houston. He actually fought in the Texas Revolution and also invented a meat stick for military use, but that one wasn't a big success, like the sweetened condensed milk. So now canning is not pasteurization. It's commercial sterilization, like Bob was talking about. So it's not quite the same thing, but similar in some ways. And then after this invention of the canned milk, I mean, that invention sparked so much research into milk preservation, it's crazy. I mean, now serving overseas in the military, you get those little cardboard milk packs. And
yeah.
Those things have a shelf life of like 3 years
or something,
ultra
high
crazy like that.
Ultra-high milks, you know, that can sit on the shelf forever. Great leaps and bounds have been made in powdered milk.
Mm-hmm.
We had a story on chocolate a while back, and we were talking about the Swiss milk chocolate, and that they used a, what was the Was it Borden? No, it wasn't Borden's milk there. What was that that they had used? There was another company in Europe that actually had developed a sweetened condensed milk about 20 years after, Borden's did. And there's a similar story with Carnation PET milk, the pet milk, during World War One. It becomes increasingly popular because they get a contract with the U.S. military and then shipped around the world. It's kind of like Spam.
All
And
kinds of canned
Spam
stuff.
got amazingly popular, especially in the Pacific, because of World War II and it being shipped all around the world. And now you can go to Denny's in Hawaii or Guam and get Spam omelets.
It's crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So let's go to 1892 now, and we're going to talk about a chemist named Ernst Lederle. And he was actually experimentally inoculating milk from tuberculosis-diseased cows into guinea pigs, which obviously led to them catching tuberculosis. And then in 1910, Lederle, then in the role of Commissioner of Health, introduced mandatory pasteurization of milk in New York City.
And a lot of that probably goes back to the Macy's even being there at that time,
Yeah,
helping to
the
lean
big push.
on the.
So let's talk about the legal aspect of pasteurization. So it kind of starts in 1912 with a guy named Milton Rosenau, and he writes this pamphlet called The Milk Question.
Yeah, he worked for the, I want to say it was like the United States Marine Health Services, which was like a U.S. Public Health Service precursor kind of a thing.
And so he talked about the dangers and risks and pasteurization and all these things. And that was kind of the spark that led to localities starting to institute pasteurization laws.
Yeah, so it went by city, then county, and it wasn't until like 1947.
1947 was when the first states started implementing pasteurization laws. And then it wasn't until 1973 that there was actually a federal law. So the US federal government at that point required pasteurization of milk used in interstate commerce.
And what you think about this, that's like a, for over 100 years now, you've known that milk carries all of these diseases that can be handled by heat treatment. But yet the dairies and the dairy lobbies are so powerful and have so much pull, not just locally, but also with the federal government and the USDA, that
It takes like 80, 90 years,
to get these regulations in place. It's,
It's crazy.
yeah.
So then here's a cool fact. According to the Centers for Disease Control, between 1998 and 2011, 79% of dairy-related disease outbreaks in the United States were due to raw milk or cheese products. They report 148 outbreaks and 2,384 illnesses, with 284 of those requiring hospitalization, as well as 2 deaths due to raw milk or cheese products during the same time period. So that is a lot. I
But
mean,
not nearly like it used to be
oh no,
back
nothing like it
before
used to
this.
be.
And, in the coronavirus day and age, we look at that and don't even
Oh yeah,
probably
that's
blink an
nothing
eye.
compared to COVID
Yeah.
numbers.
Yeah.
And I mean, not to say that all raw milk or cheese products are unhealthy or bad. As long
No.
as they're controlled and done in a clean environment by somebody you know and it's handled correctly, it can be safe.
Yes.
But for mass commercial production, it's probably not a good idea. It's
Yeah, because you
probably
just don't know
safer to
what all
use,
the customers' health issues and concerns are. So you're liable to get somebody sick out there with something. But, with this push for whole new natural foods in the United States going on, it's been going on for the last 34, it's been going on forever, but it really kind of picked up in the late 90s, and then now 20, 30 years later, you've got actual regulations by the USDA and the FDA to kind of state what, you know, natural, wholesome should actually be, or organic should actually be.
And you what have, requirements have yeah, to be met. Requirements have to be met
and certification yeah. and all that stuff. You do have like local dairies out there that serve, you know, fresh raw milk, but they know where their cattle came from. Mm-hmm. One, they know what has been fed. They know what the medical history is of the animal.
They're being regularly inspected.
Yeah. So the milk is, has a cold chain to it, and it's also the udders are being cleaned and sanitized. So I mean, there's a lot of process going on there. Hazard analysis, critical control point programs, and just handling the risk. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we're gonna get to one of my favorite stories in dairy history, which is about Al Capone.
Yep, that Al Capone.
Yep. He was a famous bootlegger, Chicago mobster from the 1920s throughout the 1930s. This was during the Prohibition period. We got to do a whole podcast on Prohibition.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't know what that is, that's when the United States actually outlawed alcohol. Didn't go over very well. Yeah, it led to a lot of crime.
Oh, yeah.
We can get into discussions about some other things that are illegal today that haven't done anything really other than, create more crime. Anyway, so Al Capone had a niece, and she wrote a book about him. And there's been a lot of people that wrote books about him, actually. But she wrote a book about him, and she starts to talk about one of the stories that's been passed around about Al Capone, and that's Al wanted to get out of the bootlegger business, and he wanted to go legitimate. Mm-hmm. He had made, actually, they thought, hundreds of millions of dollars a year off of bootlegging, prostitution, gambling, and running extortions, whatever else he was doing.
And nobody really knows exactly how much he made. No. It's just a guess, but no, it was a lot of money.
But he was the guy at the top of the game there, so that means, the other people were gunning for him. Mm-hmm. They wanted to knock him off so they could get that piece of the pie. And, he was feeling the heat, and he was wanting to get out. So he's wanting to go legit. And so he was starting to look at the dairy industry, mm-hmm. And what he actually wanted to do, and he was working with his brother on this idea, is they wanted to go to Wisconsin and bring in cheaper milk from another state into Chicago and use non-unionized milkmen, because the milkmen at that time were part of the Teamsters Milk Union, and they were delivering the milk, to places in Chicago, and it was locally, produced milk. Now, there was a huge dairy organization, and the dairy union there was gigantic, right? And so they didn't like the whole idea of Al Capone kind of getting into their area and their business. And Al didn't wait around for them to, make the first moves or take the first shots. Mm-hmm. Al actually just went out and kidnapped the president of the local union, mm-hmm. held the guy for $50,000 ransom, and then used that $50,000 ransom to go out and buy his own local dairy.
That's crazy.
And to the knowledge of the author and to his niece, that he actually didn't go to jail for that. He was never charged with that. He was actually, about 3 months after he buys this dairy, he actually gets picked up for tax evasion and goes to prison for that, and winds up spending the rest of his life, in prison. There, I think that's just a fascinating story. But Al Capone was also looked at as kind of like a folk hero in his area of Chicago, because he took care of people. Mm-hmm. As long as you weren't his enemy, he took care of people. And during the Great Depression, he actually ran soup kitchens, and he would go down there and work in the soup kitchens himself. He helped people out when they were down and out. And it's said that either it was a part of his a member of his immediate family or one of his friends had a child that got sick from some old, outdated milk. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, even though this is 1920s and 30s, they may or may not have had pasteurization. And even if they did, they didn't have a date of when you should use it by.
And it wasn't really like a regulated industry yet.
No, it still wasn't. So, you know, you got what you got, and people still got sick. And it's mm-hmm. usually the older and the younger that are going to get sick mm-hmm. and, you know, die from this. So anyway, it said that Al Capone actually starts to lean on the city commissioner's office to put in place regulations for dairy industries to put best of use by or sell by yep. dates. It's also said that Al actually owned all of the stamping equipment in the local area. So it did, you know, pretty much benefit him all the way around. Now, this story goes, and it kind of takes on a life of its own, and you start to see other authors that'll write about it, and they say that it's the start of the agro mafia, where actually these mobsters are getting out of the business of going in and, you know, directly leaning on businesses and saying, we want to, you know, 5 or 10% of your profits right off the top. They go in and say, okay, we want you to buy our cheese. And this has mm-hmm. been, you know, seems to be a true story that pizzerias in New York City and Chicago mm-hmm. were buying cheese from the dairy that Al Capone had bought that was Wisconsin cheese.
Or Wisconsin milk.
Yeah. Wisconsin milk made the cheese, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, they had their hands in every step of the process. So yeah. Like the milk, the cheese, the pizza, like, and they were making it's buy my milk, buy my cheese, buy this pizza, buy that.
They got out of the alcohol business and jumped right into the dairy business and still became fabulously rich people. Mm-hmm. Now, since he went to jail, he actually gifted the dairy that he bought to his lawyer. So kept it you know, kind of in the family there.
That's a crazy story. So we're getting close to the end. So we'll end this podcast with an incredible but true story of an ancient Japanese
cheese
called Sa.
Sa.
S-O, but I think it's pronounced Sa.
Yeah.
Who could be wrong? Like,
the O is pronounced like lot. So, yeah, Sa.
And so this cheese was popular until the time of the shogunates in Japan, when farmers didn't have time to tend to the cows and cheese, as they were often tending to their warriors' horses. And so, like, as it was popular in the time, but during that feudal Japanese society, it kind of went to the wayside. Mm-hmm. Now, however, like, in recent history, during the coronavirus and subsequent quarantines, Japanese people had plenty of time on their hands, and they actually began to blog about recipes for this cheese. So it's made kind of a resurgence.
Yeah.
It's basically a full-fat milk that is slowly boiled down to a gelatinous mass and then refrigerated.
Part of this is that, just like in the United States, the Japanese dairy industry was basically getting decimated because of the quarantine. They made a lot of money off the school systems. They actually, you know, served children breakfast and lunch in the schools, and they have to give them a, you know, that's not a pint of milk there. I can't remember what size it was, but it was in the metric system. Mm-hmm. And it's similar in the United States, where if a school wants to be reimbursed for a school lunch program, they have to offer, you know, a pint of milk for every kid that's been served. And you kind of go back and you think about, you know, our first story, we were talking about the poultry industry and the regulations and, you know, forcing some of these meat industries to actually continue to produce, even though that we are, they had people that had coronavirus. You can't just stop because you can't just make a chicken, a cow, mm-hmm. you know, you can't just stop a cow from growing, producing milk.
Yeah.
and then start it back overnight.
It's a process. Like stopping any part of the chain leads to like second, third, fourth order effects.
Yeah.
That make restarting the industry that much more difficult.
Yeah, so you start to see the Japanese starting to make this cheese again, and you get the dairy industry is getting in on the act and starting to push it a little bit more. And so it's kind of taking on its life of its own. And it's not just in Japan anymore. It's starting to kind of show up in Europe and the Americas and, you know, all over the world. You know, people are, you know, bored to death during the quarantine and looking for different things to do.
Actually, one of my coworkers has recently dabbled in making his own cheese. So he gets raw milk. It's a raw milk cheese. Mm-hmm. He gets raw milk from some local dairy farmer around here, and he's been making different kind of cheeses. I don't know what he's been making, but that's been his pastime during this quarantine.
Yeah, and you know, if you don't want to buy yogurt ever again, you know, you can just start making it at home. Take a spoonful of yogurt, dip it in a glass of milk, let it sit for 24 to 48 hours, and you're going to get yogurt.
More yogurt.
Keep it cold, though. I mean, it's going to grow a little bit slower, but you want to keep it safe. The higher the fat in the milk, the better the cheese is going to be, the better the yogurt, you know, because it's the fats where the flavor is, also where the fermentation process, you've got the sugars that are there and the organisms that are going to be in there attacking the sugars and the fats and using it to produce lactic acid, which gives you that taste. The more fat that's in it, the better it's going to be. It's better ice cream when it's high fat. You got that kind of creaminess on the top roof of your mouth, you know? I'm just not a big low-fat milk fan, sorry.
Nah, I'm a whole milk guy.
Yeah.
The fatter, the better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess to kind of finish this off, let's talk about milk and strong bones.
Yeah, you know, that you always hear about that. You got to drink your milk for strong bones and teeth. But it seems that the research is kind of out on some of that. Mm-hmm. You know, the research on whether or not milk helps to prevent you from breaking bones or fracturing bones doesn't seem to be really there. However, there is quite a bit of research to the fact that milk does help you build strong muscles.
It helps with muscle growth, yeah.
You got the whey proteins in there. Mm-hmm. There's a whole industry around that with dairy as well, where the proteins are being taken out and sent to health food stores. Actually, dairy, that's why I was saying that there's dairy science, right? You can get a PhD in this because there's just so much that dairy is being used for. It's kind of like sugar. You can find it in some form. And just about everything that you eat, and it comes out of a processed food, a can, in some sort of way.
And fun fact, you know how milk is always touted as like the big source of vitamin D?
Yeah.
Broccoli actually has more vitamin D than milk. So if you're vitamin D deficient, eat some broccoli. Maybe drink some milk too, but eat some broccoli.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. Shout out to the vegans in the group here. Yeah, right? And so we're big, like, whole food kind of fans, people. Like, we like to have fresh vegetables and fresh meat. We try to limit the amount of sugar that we take in.
Try to limit the processed foods.
Processed foods that you can. We've done the actual Whole30 diet. We're on our second round of it. Yeah. You can scream and yell at us all you want to, but believe me, when you eliminate the sugar, you start to lose weight.
Mm-hmm. And you sleep better.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to it. I'm not a big fan of eliminating the bread and the dairy, but we do it.
Mm-hmm. It's a necessary evil.
It makes you love it all much more when you go back to it, though. It does. Okay, so I think we've milked this subject for all it's worth. Those great dad jokes. Just utterly humorous.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so the next time that you drink a glass of milk, think of the science, the history, and all the crime that's passed between your lips down into your stomach as you enjoy that next glass of milk. So, historians, that's all for this podcast. So until next time.
You've been listening to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History with Bob and Tom.
That was radical.
The number one audio production for people with nothing better to do.
That was amazing.
For more info, head over to healthwealthandhistory.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time.